Lord, when I saw that bright sunshine, I didn't have no doubt. Oh Lord, I didn't have no doubt in my mind.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Okay, I'll read just one short passage now. And this is a passage, the 3rd U.S. Colored Cavalry's greatest achievement was to take a bridge, which a couple of other regiments had tried to take, and they couldn't take it. The bridge had to be taken, and they sent these black soldiers in there to take it in a swamp, deep in a swamp. And they took the bridge up near the big Black River Bridge. Mm-hmm. And because we have some folks from Mississippi here, right? But they went up there and they took the bridge. And I'm just going to give you, here's what I did. I'll tell you afterwards what I did. But this is just a little scene that I put in the attack. And Joe is standing there right now. And he's got his buddy with him. You'll tell his buddy soon. You see his buddy Zach, okay? And they're just there. And they're holding the line against these Confederates because the bridge is back there. And they got to hold it while the bridge is burnt, okay? But his master is leading the Confederates against them, okay? So now he's already beat them back once. And then Joe kept his eyes up there on the woods where the rebels had gone, thinking, hoping it was all over now. The master had already been wounded. But no, there came the sound of that drum again. That little colored boy who was beating the drum for the Confederates had been small. And they tried not to shoot him, but here come that little fellow again, drumming again. A line of rebels right behind him. And the Colonel Kenworthy, who was his master, right behind him. This time, the Colonel didn't have a saber. He couldn't have carried a saber anyhow. But what the hell did he have? Joe knew the answer when he heard first one bark, then two barks, then shit. Sounded like a whole pack of dogs. The Colonel, this time on a horse, was leading a bunch of men forward. And each of them had 5 or 6 bloodhounds on a leash. Hellfire and damnation. Now, leaning to one side of his horse, Colonel Kenworthy raised his hand, and he advanced on Joe's lines at a trot, followed by his pack of bloodhounds. There must have been 30 or 40 of them. The colonel wasn't able to keep up with his men. A sergeant took the lead, breaking into a run. Just behind the dogs was a line of infantry. They were going to use those dogs just like they was cavalry. Now, Joe had seen his men face a lot and stand strong, but dogs? Probably nigger dogs trained to attack colored folk. All right. Man, do you see what's coming? Sergeant, some mean-looking bastards. Shut the hell up. They ain't nothing but dogs. Joe moved along the line. You men that got sabers, you stand right up there, right behind the men laying down there with those carbines. Dogs get in here, you hack them up. We ain't letting that bridge fall. Now that damn Tucker was getting up like he was going to run. Zach, put your pistol aside Tucker's head. He moved anyway before, would you shoot him? The barking was louder now, and the rebs were about 25 yards away. Colonel Kenworthy had to be way back now. But he wasn't so far back that his voice didn't carry. He said, Joe, can you hear me, Joe? Nigger dogs are gonna chew your black asses up. Right? I hears you all right. They're gonna try just the way you tried to whip me under that pine tree that day. Come on, Colonel. I ain't scared of you and I ain't scared of your damn dogs. He dropped to his knees. Steady, men, fire when I give the command. There were 15, 20, 12, 10, Joe. He gave the command to fire the same time the rebs released the dogs. Sick 'em, boys, make the niggas run. The dogs leapt forth, they yelping and barking like they'd been thrown a whole pan full of bloody red beef. And when the volley from the carbines hit those dogs, There was a wild confusion of yelling and barking, men and dogs all tangled and wrestling in pools of blood on the slippery grass, hellish mingling of screams and howls, punctuated by the sound of pistols and carbines exploding all over the field with quick flashes. Now, Joe tried to shut it out, worked with his knife and his revolver, tried to ignore that coppery odor of blood mixed with smoke. Everywhere he looked wasn't nothing but hand-to-hand fighting or hand-to-throat fighting. And the worst thing, there wasn't no line no more. A brown and white hound leaped for his throat. He stuck his knife right in the bitch's belly. But she had no more than fallen to the ground than another one was tearing at his other arm. Joe swirled around so hard the dog went flying through the air. Shot him in the air. He shot him in midair with his pistol. Fight, you poker-loving bastards! We the Third Cavalry, he yelled. Take more than these hellhounds to finish us off. And now he saw that a group of his men had formed around him again, that they had a line. And little by little, the barking got fainter, and the firing seemed thinner, till he turned, and he saw only one bloodhound left, standing over a fallen Third Cavalry man, tearing away at his throat. Now Joe threw the knife right into its side, boom, and heard his own savage yell as the dog collapsed. The Rebs were retreating at a trot, not a dog left in sight. And Colonel Kenworthy, he could barely keep up with him. He must be hurt pretty bad. That bastard wouldn't be back today. Oh, what damage he had done, though. All around him, the men lay dead and dying, torn and mangled, side by side with the dogs' bloody red carcasses strewn across the green field. The bang of wounded and dying dogs filled the air. It was another long 15 minutes before he heard them blow recall down there at the bridge. Gradually, what was left of his men made their way down the hill, firing back at the rebels as they went. Major Cook was waiting. Was that dogs I heard? All Joe could do was nod, but his look and men's torn and bloody uniforms said the rest. God will have to forgive them, but I cannot, the major said. You and your men did yourselves proud, Sergeant. Sir? Captain Stiles, because Captain Stiles, his captain had been wounded. Captain Stiles, he'll live. He's on his way back to the main unit. You'll take command of the company in his absence. Dismissed. Yes, sir. And now we're going to hear the song from which I took the title for the book, which is Come and Go With Me to That Land.
Don't you wanna go to that land?
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. It was a blessing to have them here. You don't know how much it meant to me. Thank you, darling. Yes?
I want to know what happened to Zenobia.
You got to buy the book. How long did it take me to write the book? It took me really writing about altogether 4 years. But really writing, when I sat down to write the first draft out, I wrote it out in 3 months. But I was up every morning, like 5 o'clock, get on the treadmill, listen to my music, get to the computer, and I'd write for about 3 or 4 hours before 12 o'clock. Then I'd take it over to the cafeteria if the students were still there and have somebody read it. Right. Well, what inspired me to write the book was, when I was growing up, I always wanted to have, you know, a positive, you're always looking for black heroes and trying to find something that makes you feel happy about you and who you came from. And I always knew from folk I talked to sometimes about what black people had done to free themselves, but there was never anything out there that you could really put your hands on and that an ordinary person could read to see how, and they actually did that. And the Lord blessed me to be able to write fiction. It took me a long time to learn how to write fiction and to be able to get through a PhD and to be a trained historian and political scientist. And I just thought, if God gives you a talent, you gotta use it. So that's what I tried to do. And I must say, you know, I'm inspired every day by a lot of my undergraduates, because I know how hard it's been for some of them. And I wanted to actually match the spirit of the students, of my students. I see how hard they work, against what obstacles they kind of struggle sometimes. And I want to do something that would uplift them. All right? Well, the Third Cavalry, because number one, there's a great book written on it, a regimental history, which had all of its exploits in it. And at the back of that regimental history, there's an 18-page sketch on Alfred Wood. And these things I'm talking about, that trip across the river, he did, right? He did a lot of other things. And I said, man, here I got me some cavalry, right? You know, I got horses and things, right? And here I am in the Civil War. And, you know, when you grow up, you know, I grew up reading the Three Musketeers and all that kind of thing, man, and, you know, watching all these John Wayne movies and stuff. Well, I got my own John Wayne here, right? Right? Okay. Right. That's what I said. Frank asked me a question. Did I go down there and visit the area? No. I was not able to because I had like a real major thing I had to do. I had like 3 months period, right, in the summer. Now, to visit, I figured this thing out, right? To visit is gonna take me a month, all right? And if I made the visit, by the time I come back, I'm not gonna get that thing, that first draft done. So I did the first draft, and then realistically, I mean, I would have liked to, but the stories of the Civil War and tales from the slave tales and the slave narratives and stuff, the tales and the diaries of the soldiers and stuff who fought down in that territory, those people could write. They didn't watch television, right? Right. So they could write, and they had these descriptions, and, you know, descriptions of snakes falling down and wildcats jumping out the trees on them and stuff. You know, I didn't need, I was able to use my imagination from there, all right? The question is, how many drafts did I do prior to the final draft? I did At a minimum, I'd say about 15, at a minimum. Because you see, you can write, like I said, 3 months, Frank. Well, that 3 months was simply to get a rough draft. Now I got it all in front of me, and now I have to work with it. In other words, I see possibilities. I read over it, and I see possibilities here, possibilities there to do this and to do that, and to expand it here and expand it there. And then once you got it expanded, you got all these things in there, then you have the other job, which is you gotta go through it now and you gotta make sure everything is perfect. Everything's gotta be perfect, because this is a hard thing to do. You gotta fix it so that everybody believes that they're in another world. And one little thing is not right. You understand? One little thing is not right. And you say, man, I won't read this book. Because you basically, so you have to go over in like sentence and word by word. So, and reverse words and stuff. So that's what I'm talking about. It's a hard process. But once you got it out there, you can work with it. They're on the computer. they're on the computer. They're on the computer. No, I don't want to do anything else from that now. I'm done. No, I ain't going back there again. No. I'm sorry, I didn't hear. You never complete a book. I mean, it's like, you know, like all, you think you're done. And they accept it down there, you know, a year or so ago, right? But every time you think you're done, but then they call up and they want this. And they call up and they want that. And I felt like I completed the book tonight. Right, to now it's complete. right. That's what it felt like. More important was the characters and their feelings. The history you can find sooner or later, but I wanted people to read the book. And the only way you read a book or a novel, you know, we all like the same thing. I'll be reading 2 or 3 pages and no, right? But you gotta be engaged with people. So the characters and their development was more important for me. I didn't write it for her. She changed language. But she said, it was very flattering what she said. She said that she didn't know of the characters are so appealing. And the description is from an African-American perspective, and she didn't know of another book that would give that society, African-American side of what slavery was like and what they did to free themselves. And that's why she used it. And I hadn't intended it that way, but no, I intended it for, you know, a basic audience. I chose the title because the song kept, number one, my grandmother used to sing it when I was a child. Number two, that there's a great folk singer. Remember, I used to play sometimes a tape of Odetta. She sings a song, Come With Me to That Land Where I'm Bound. That always made a big impression on me. And then when I, you know, as I'm writing and stuff, the song just would come to me. You know, it just came to me as I was writing. And because he's got, where are they bound? They're bound for freedom. They're bound for freedom. And they're going to get there one way or another. And that's why I put it there. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I was with Gorbachev. We would sit and drink Russian wine. And I'd play my guitar, and we'd sing Russian folk songs and African-American songs. We had some good evenings together. we were young then. We could do a lot of things. Yeah. No, Zenobia is composite to me of the beauty of black women, of African American women. She's just that. I mean, yeah. And that's what she is. right. So, thank you all for coming, and you know, you've been great.
I want to add to that. Thank you so much, Helen Ballard. And thank you, members of the church choir. It's been a delight to have you here. Thank you all for coming.